surface. 20 seconds to give him brain damage. 30 seconds to kill him. My fight function is now engaged. That, combined with my rage and my thirst, leaves me uncertain of which of the three outcomes I want. Kelton, enough! I snap out of it at the sound of Alyssa's voice and release Henry's throat, grateful that she was there to make the right decision for me, because I know I might not have. Henry gasps and coughs and gasps again. There's no fight or even flight left in him now. He's little more than a rag doll on the ground, just as he was when I dislocated his shoulder.
Call off your goddamn pit bull,
he rasps.
It's okay, Kelton, Alyssa says. He's not going anywhere.
And so I let him go. Not because I want to, but because the orders Alyssa is giving me now are the first thing she said to me all day. By now, Garrett and Jackie have arrived, and it looks like I'm not the only one harboring homicidal intentions, because Jackie pulls out my gun and aims it point blank at Henry's forehead.
I will be solving so many problems if I pull this trigger, she growls.
Stop it, demands Alyssa. Killing him won't solve anything.
All right, maybe not, but it'll feel really good.
Put that away,
Alyssa yells. But Jackie is not following anyone's commands, least of all Alyssa's. And then Henry begins to grovel for his life.
Please, he whimpers. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for everything.
The only thing you're sorry for is being caught,
says Jackie, which is probably true. And then Garrett, feeling this betrayal more deeply than anyone, says,
Do it. Do it, Jackie.
Alyssa reels at that horrified.
Garrett! Do it! He deserves it! He lied to us! He tricked us! He pretended to be our friend!
As I recall, Garrett had also wanted me to pull the trigger on the blonde water zombie at the beach. Now, a stain spreads across Henry's crotch. He's wet himself. Not much of a stain. He doesn't have much water in him. I have no sympathy. Maybe I will if Jackie shoots him. Right now, not so much. Jackie looks at Garrett, almost as surprised by his outburst as Alyssa is. Then she ejects the magazine and fires the bullet that's already in the chamber into the sky. It echoes back and forth between the mountains around us.
What is wrong with you?
Alyssa yells.
If I didn't shoot it in the sky, it would be in his skull right now, Jackie says.
More likely the ground right behind his skull, I point out, being that it's such close range. Jackie storms off, and Alyssa burns Garrett a glare.
Go with her. Make sure she doesn't do anything stupid.
Like I could stop her.
Alyssa holds her brother's gaze, and I know what she's thinking. Are you broken, Garrett? Has all of this broken you worse than it's broken the rest of us? And if the gun was in your hands, would Henry be dead now?
Just go, she says.
Now it's just me, Alyssa, and Henry. He's recovered enough to make a run for it, but he doesn't even try because he knows I'll just take him down again, and he's deathly afraid of me. Funny, but no one has ever actually thought of me as a legitimate threat before. No one's ever called me a pit bull. Mostly, kids like Henry have either ignored me or seen me as a joke. But now, I'm Kelton, the Intimidator. If I survive this, I'll have a shirt made.
I just want to know why, Alyssa says.
Henry can't look at her. Good. He doesn't deserve to look at her anymore.
If I didn't have something to offer, you would have just left me there, in Dove Canyon, to die along with everyone else.
So you lied.
I never said there was water in that box. You just assumed.
Alyssa looks like she might kick him.
That look is sweet revenge.
Almost as good as if she actually did kick him. But since she doesn't, I do a little bit of my own tormenting.
If we change our minds, there's a shovel back in the bug out, I say. And the ground here on the ridge is soft enough to dig a grave.
I'll make it up to you, Henry pleads. All of you, I promise.
Just shut up, Henry, Alyssa says, or I swear I'll get that shovel myself.
35. Alyssa.
Henry may have killed us all.
I don't want that thought in my head. I want to focus on the solution, not the problem. But the thought keeps worming back in, undermining every attempt to root it out. I think of all the things we might have done differently if we knew there was no water in that box, including leaving Henry in his fancy air-conditioned house. But who am I kidding? If I knew he had no water left and he wanted to come with us, I would have fought to bring him with us. But had we known, maybe we could have made a real backup plan. Now we have nothing. Nothing but despair and that singular nagging thought. Henry may have killed us all. We take him back to the bug out with us, because if we just let him go, he'll probably die before he gets out of the woods, and I don't want that on my conscience. Jackie insists on binding his hand so he can't do much of anything, and so he won't forget he is now under house arrest. I don't argue with her because maybe it's the right move. I trusted Henry, and look where it got us. Even Kelton agrees that it's better having him under our watchful eyes than out there where we can't see what he's up to. From this moment on, the best policy is suspicion on all fronts. In the bug out, we strategize our next move. Garrett is despondent, just slumped in a corner. "I'm conserving energy," he says. "Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Conserve energy?" "We have enough gas to get back to the freeway," I tell everyone. "We'll find Charity, let her know what happened. She'll help us." "If she hasn't been taken out by marauders," says Jackie, a ray of light, as always. "I have a better idea," says Kelton. Then he searches through a few drawers until coming up with a map. He spreads it out on the small kitchen table. "We're here," he says, pointing. "And Charity's there, about 30 miles away. But look at this." He brings his finger out to a long, Y-shaped lake west of us. "The San Gabriel Reservoir." Jackie scoffs at it. "Haven't you heard? The reservoirs are all dry. That's what you get for looking at an old paper map." "Yes," says Kelton. "The Cogswell and Morris reservoirs are gone, but the lake behind the San Gabriel Dam is maintained for firefighting aircraft. I'm sure of it." "How can you be sure about anything?" Jackie snorts. "Because it's why my father chose this spot for the bug out. It will be way down from its usual level, but there will still be some water there." By checking the distances on the map, I can tell it's just 10 miles west of us, much closer than going back to Charity. "We'll have to go totally off-road for a while. We can cross this ridge here," Kelton says, dragging his finger along the paper, "and pick up East Fork Road here. That will wind to the lake." "Sounds like a plan," says Henry from his spot in the corner. Jackie kicks him, not hard enough to hurt him, but just enough to make it clear his input is not welcome anymore. "Are we all game for this?" Kelton asks. The answer is no, but no one admits that, because if we want to live, it's the best choice we have. There are a few backpacks and drawstring bags around the bug out. I gather them up and hand them out. "Let's look around and grab things we might need, but don't weigh yourselves down." I'm about to hand one to Henry, but he holds up his bound hands and shrugs. If I want him to participate, I'll need to cut him loose. So I don't give him a bag. Then Jackie does something I'd never expect her to. She gives Kelton back his gun. "Here, take it," she says. "I don't want it in my belt anymore. It's giving me a rash." Then she glances over at Henry. "Besides, I don't trust myself with it, considering our current company." Kelton takes the gun back, surprised by the offer. "So you trust me now?" "Absolutely not," Jackie says. "But at least if you do something stupid, it will be your problem, not mine." Jackie herself is a loaded gun with a hair trigger, and the fact that she, in this moment, is able to recognize that makes her seem slightly less mental, maybe even trustworthy. I open the pantry, trying to see if there's anything other than the dry ramen cups. Nothing, but that doesn't mean we won't find something lying around. We should probably eat anything we find that's actually edible, I tell the others. We'll need the energy. I pick up the spoon with dried peanut butter, hold it out to Garrett, and he gives me a look of profound disgust. Beggars can't be choosers, I tell him. Obviously, you've never met the beggars in Laguna Beach, Jackie says. I happen to know several of them. And then she starts to mimic them in various different voices. Hey, lady, this sandwich has a bite taken out of it. Excuse me, but is this bread gluten-free? Just a dollar, dude. Maybe you could send me a little more on Venmo. It sets me off giggling, which gets everyone else laughing. And it occurs to me that even in these do-or-die moments, there's still space for us to laugh. I guess that means we still have some fight left in us.
Kelton.
There is absolutely no reason for me to take comic books with me. They will take up space, and I'm definitely not going to be reading them. But there they are on the floor of the second bedroom. The room that was supposed to be for me and Brady if our family ever had to use the bug out. As I lean over to pick them up, I can smell his sheets. Sour. There's no air conditioning in the bug out. Just a fan powered off the same miniature solar grid that powers the lights. The fan probably drains the battery halfway through the night. It smells like his room used to when he lived at home. A faint, vinegary reek that would cause Mom to break out the Febreze on a regular basis. After today, I will never smell that again. I'm taking his comic books. I don't need them, but I don't care. I'm taking them anyway. Then, when I look up, Alyssa is standing at the door. I don't know how long she's been there watching me. I pick up the comic books and put them on the bed. I won't let her see me pack them. This is between me and Brady. My brother was a real screw-up, I tell her. I mean, he uses up everything in the bug-out, doesn't answer our calls, and then shows up at home just in time to get himself killed. If that's not the definition of screw-up, I don't know what is. I'm sorry, Kelton. And then, things start coming out of my mouth that I don't mean to say out loud, but I can't stop myself. I don't have a brother anymore. I might not have parents. I don't even know what happens if I live through this. I mean, if my parents are gone too, what then? Do I go to Boise to live with my goddamn Aunt Eunice and her cats? How is that better than dying of thirst? Tomorrow is going to have to take care of itself for a while, Alyssa says. Then she adds, yesterday too. I know what yesterday she's talking about. I force myself to hold her gaze, no matter how raw and stupidly naked I feel in front of her. And make no mistake about it, this is the true meaning of nakedness. If I had no clothes on, that would be nothing compared to the kind of bareness that's exposed to her right now. Saying I'm sorry for that thing I did in eighth grade feels stupid. Because sorry isn't enough. Sorry is almost an insult. You're right. It's not enough, she says. People go to jail for stuff like that. True, but I'm a minor, I point out. I'd have just gotten juvie and counseling, but yeah, I get your point. I look down at the comic book in my hand, which I've managed to spindle without even realizing it. I lay it flat and try to smooth it out. I won't even say it seemed like a good idea at the time, because even then, I knew it was a really bad idea. But you did it anyway. Haven't you ever done something really stupid, and you knew it was stupid, but did it anyway? She bristles at the suggestion. Maybe because she's never done anything so entirely stupid and misguided in her whole life. I realize she has not once asked me why I did it. Maybe because she knows. The truth is, loneliness and hormones and parents who keep you like a fish in a bowl can do weird things to a person. Life through a fishbowl lens is only one step away from life behind the lens of a drone's camera.
It was the creepiest thing I've ever done, and I was so disgusted with myself, I never did it again. I hope she believes me, because it's true. Then Alyssa asks me the last thing I expect her to ask. So, what did you see? Huh? I say. Not because I didn't hear her, but because I'm not ready to go there. You looked. You saw. I want to know what you stole from me that night. I wonder what she's expecting me to say. I wonder what she wants me to say. It doesn't matter because I just tell her the truth. It was the week of that air band contest at school, you remember that? She groans. I try not to. Anyway, you and your friends had been practicing a routine, lip-syncing some ridiculous pop song, but I guess you couldn't get the moves right because that night you were in your room by yourself. You turned on the song, and you were practicing in the mirror. Really? She says flatly. Is that what you wasted your drone on? You were using Kingston's brush as a microphone, but dog hair kept whipping in your face and it kept throwing you off. I remember thinking, here she is, looking in the mirror, watching herself doing something so silly and so dumb, but she doesn't feel dumb about it at all. But me? I can't even look in the mirror and do anything without feeling like an idiot. That's where you're wrong, Kelton, she says. I did feel like an idiot. But I did it anyway. Then she asks me to stand up for a second, so I do. I'm facing her, not quite sure what this is about, until she suddenly hauls off and slaps me. This is not your ordinary slap. This is like a Major League Baseball swing with a wind-up and full follow-through. My head whips nearly around with the force of it. It leaves me in shock. I can't even speak. And I know there's going to be a puffy red handprint on my left cheek for a good long time. Finally, I find my words somewhere in the far corner of my rattled brain. I guess I deserve that, I tell her. Yes, you did, she says. Are we even? No, we're not. I sigh. I didn't think so. Part of your punishment is that we'll never be even. And I get that. The worst part about doing something inexcusable is that you can never take it back. It's like breaking a glass. It can't unbreak. The best you can do is sweep it up and hope you don't step on the slivers you left behind. But then, she leans in and places a gentle kiss on my stinging cheek, like a mother kissing a little kid's boo-boo. She leaves without a word of explanation. And I come to the grand realization that from now and until the end of the universe, if I live 100,000 lifetimes, I will never understand girls. And somehow, that's okay, I think.
Part 5. Hell and High Water. 37. Jackie.
My mouth is dry and tastes like I've been chewing the soles of old Nikes. It tastes like I've been sucking mud. Moist, glistening mud. It's actually enticing. Never mind an ice-cold can of Dr. Pepper dripping with beads of condensation. I'd definitely settle for mud right now. Funny how the needs of your own body redefine the parameters of what you'd settle for. I climb behind the wheel again. Whether Alyssa likes it or not, I'm the one who has to drive, because Henry sure as hell isn't, and as neither Kelton nor Alyssa are anywhere close to having a license, they have no other choice. It's either that or walk. My father felt I needed to earn the privilege of driving, Kelton says as we get in, but I think he was afraid of giving me too much freedom. Alyssa's reason is more self-imposed. I put off getting my license because of soccer practice, homework, and the fact that I know my parents couldn't afford to get me a car right now, so what was the point? For people who want to survive, I tell them both, you made some pretty useless life choices. Oh, Alyssa snaps. And your choices were good ones? Just shut up, yells Garrett. Everyone just shut up! And so we do. Because grumbling at each other isn't helping anything, And besides, our voices are all beginning to sound raspy. Pushing air across my vocal cords is hurting more and more, and I know it can't just be me. "When this is over," Henry says as I start the car, "I hope we'll all be able to let bygones be bygones." "When this is over," I tell him, "it will be my absolute pleasure to never see any of you ever again, but you especially." I put the car in gear and turn on the useless fan. I'm not exactly sure of the time, but it's much hotter than it was when we arrived. 10 in the morning, maybe? 11? Kelton points out that even non-functioning air conditioning makes us burn gas faster, and I tell him where he can shove his useful information. Gas is not the problem anymore. We have more than enough to get us where we're going. The problem is we're facing a classic example of, you can't get there from here. The map showed that the road we took into the forest turns away from where we need to go, so the only way to get to East Fork Road is to either backtrack 20 miles or go through the woods, which, according to Kelton, is only a 4-mile trek. One of the maps Kelton brought shows elevation and the steepness of the terrain, so we know how to get there without falling off a cliff. Unfortunately, it doesn't show trees and boulders. We have to meander like a Mars rover to forge our way through the woods, weaving a slow and unpredictable path. "I don't even know if we're going the right way anymore," I say, only realizing after it's out of my mouth that I've said it out loud. "We are," says Kelton, although he doesn't sound too confident. Then, halfway down the next slope, a bright yellow plane rips overhead. My first instinct is to jump out of the car to shout and wave like a deranged island castaway, but before I can give in to the impulse, the plane is gone. "That's a firefighting craft," Kelton says excitedly. "See, didn't I tell you? It's going the same place we're going, which means we're headed in the right direction." It's the first bit of encouraging news we've had in a long while. We continue to zigzag up and down the hills. Every bump hurts, not just my head, but my bones. Whatever it is that lubricates joints, I think, must be in low supply now, because every moving part aches. My fever's gone, so I know it's not that. It's the thirst. Has to be. "Watch out!" Alyssa yells. I slam on the brakes and turn left to avoid hitting a tree that seemed to have leaped suicidally into our path. Yes, I know it must have been right in front of me, but I'm just not seeing things right. It's not that my vision is blurry, it's just that my brain isn't doing a good job of creating the full picture. As slow as I'm going to have to slow down even more. Suddenly, it seems like going back to Charity would have been the better idea, but it's too late now. At this rate, we might not reach the road until dark, and the thought of that fills me with such misery I have to fight it with fury. How dare this forest be so hard to navigate? I think to the parts of it that are burning down, and although arson is not in my personal bag of issues, I have no sympathy. Right now, trees and nature are the enemies.
38. Henry.
My wrists hurt from the plastic tie cutting into my skin. What do they think I'm going to do if I have my hands free? Strangle someone? Well, maybe I might. Now. I'm up against the right side door. I could try to lift the lock when no one's looking, open the door, and throw myself out, but what good would that do? No. My fate is tied in with everyone else in this truck. Until the moment it isn't. I must keep my wits about me, because there are always opportunities. Even when all options seem to be gone, fortunes could change at any time. I must be ready to seize the moment when they do.
39. Kelton.
Headache. Rapid heartbeat. Exhaustion. Burning eyes. Dizziness. I know the symptoms of acute dehydration. We could go maybe 6 or 7 more hours without water now. Then we fall into a coma. Then we die. Simple as that. How much water will it take to save us? More than a thimbleful, less than a cup. It won't really hydrate us, but it will keep us from dying. It will give us time. But I don't think there's as much as a cup of water between here and our destination. We have to get there. Period. Right now, our lives depend on my ability to navigate and Jackie's ability to drive. But what if I'm wrong, and the San Gabriel Reservoir is as dry as the rest of them? Do we just lie down on the cracked, dry mud of the lake bed and call it a day? I find myself thinking about all of the second and third place ribbons and trophies in my room. Everything from robotics to marksmanship to chess boxing. My father said it was okay to have a few of them up, but didn't want me to display the rest. He felt all those non-winning awards would be a shrine to mediocrity, and such a thing was beneath me. But my mother overruled him, so the wall was enshrined. On good days, I could look at it and see the accomplishments. On bad days, it was a reminder of all the ways I am deficient. So I guess they were both right. But when it comes to survival, all I know is that there are no second and third place trophies. There's just the gold or the ground. And I don't think the others realize how close we are to the end of the line.
40. Garrett.
Where are you, Mom and Dad? Are you as thirsty as we are? I think I'm gonna die. But if you're already dead, I'm not so scared. Except I am scared. But not so scared if you're there and you're waiting for me, and if there's water. Or does thirst follow you there? What if that stupid longing for something cold and wet doesn't go away even after you die? I could swallow a river right now. I could drink Niagara Falls. My eyes are open and they hurt when I close them, and they hurt when I open them again. The corners where tears come out feel like someone stuck a pin in them, they're so dry. So I squint, trying not to open my eyes too wide. I see the windshield, and I think, for a moment, that it's a TV screen and I'm just watching TV. All of this is someone else's pretend life. It's like I fell asleep in front of the screen with my eyes open. And that's a good feeling. And so I let the feeling linger until it feels a little bit true, and I feel a little bit better. There are people talking now, but I don't think there's anyone actually speaking. And that's how I know I've started dreaming. But I'm still awake, too. I don't know what that means. But then I think maybe, just maybe, this is what it's like when you start turning into a water zombie.
41. Alyssa.
Just don't think about it. Make yourself not think about it. I remember hearing somewhere that the human mind can only hold three things in conscious thought at any given time, and if I fill up all three spaces, I won't think about how thirsty I am. Think about the reservoir. No, because that will just make me think of the water I don't have. Think about school, and that last bit of homework I never did, and biology, mitosis, meiosis, protein synthesis. It all requires water. Not helpful. Subject 1. Soccer. I'm driving toward the goal, passing back and forth, and wonder of wonders, Hallie actually passes the ball to me instead of hogging it. Good. Good. Second subject. Geography. I think of states, countries. My father got me a geography coloring book when he found out that the asinine California school system decided they didn't need to teach geography anymore. A coloring book? Really? And yet, it was great. I would think I was procrastinating when, in reality, I was memorizing the geography of the world. France is green and looks like a man with a goatee and his nose in the air. Egypt is a yellow trapezoid with one right angle and looks like the cornerstone of a pyramid. Greenland is blue, just to be ironic. So soccer and geography. Good. Subject 3. What is subject 3? Spanish. Sí, español. Pedro tiene la bolsa de María. ¿Dónde está el baño? Quiero agua. Por favor. Agua, agua, agua. This isn't working. I turn to see that Henry is watching me. I wonder what he's thinking. And then I realize I don't care. Soccer, geography, Spanish. That's all I can care about right now. I'm not the terrible person you think I am, Henry tells me. If you met me in the real world, I know you would have liked me. But we never would have met, so why does it matter? I point out. You live in a mansion in a gated community and go to an expensive private school. What are the chances that we would ever have met? It's not a mansion, he says. It's just a house, and we might have met if you came to visit your uncle. He looks off into space as if imagining that alternate reality. If we had met, I would have asked you out to a fancy dinner, and I'd be sweet and considerate and listen to everything you said. And when I wasn't listening, I'd be charming you with my sparkling wit. Sparkling, echoes Garrett wistfully, and I know he's thinking of something cold with bubbles. You would have liked me, Henry says again. I did like you, I remind him. Henry sighs. Past tense. Maybe I can make it present tense again. I don't answer him. Right now, I have no interest in connection with anybody. The only thing I want to connect with is liquid across my lips. I could fall in love with a glass of water much more than a human being right now. Jackie suddenly stops the car. Are we there? Garrett says weakly. Please tell us we're there. Quiet, Jackie says. Do you hear that? She rolls down her window the rest of the way. The stench of smoke is stronger now than before. I wonder if the winds have shifted in our direction. Now with the windows down, we can all hear what she heard. There's music. Someone's playing music.
Kelton.
This could be a really good thing, but there's a voice inside of me. Most likely my father's paranoid voice, telling me to be careful. That things that seem too good to be true always are, without exception, too good to be true. We should check it out, says Alyssa. I'll go, I tell everyone, before someone else volunteers. Always the Boy Scout, sneers Jackie, and although I expect her to argue, she says, fine, the rest of us will stay here and enjoy the non-existent air conditioning. It's an indication of how much the thirst is getting to her, if she's willing to let me take charge of the situation. But volunteering for this has nothing to do with my being a Boy Scout. It has to do with caution over curiosity, which I have right now much more than any of the others. I am just paranoid enough to hedge my hope, and that could be something that saves us. It's torturous getting to the top of the ridge. Even though it's not all that steep, it's just a few dozen yards ahead of us. My legs are weak, and I'm dizzy, but I can fight that. For now. As soon as I get to the top, I hide behind a tree and peer out. The music's louder, and now I recognize the tune. It's Kashmir, by Led Zeppelin. That familiar, relentless beat, and exotic, yet somehow ominous riff fills the air. Robert Plant's voice wails above it all like some sort of religious chant. There's a small camper down there. An old one. Rusty. Must have been there for a long time. This is a bug out. I recognize that right away. Nothing as elaborate as ours, but a bug out all the same. Two men sit out front in folding chairs. They have weapons. Nasty ones, which isn't surprising. They are roasting rabbits over an open fire. How stupid to have an open flame when everything's so dry. But I sense that consequences are not a high priority for these men. And then one of them lifts a water bottle to his lips. The power of my craving is like an electrical surge. It's almost impossible to resist. I want to hurl myself down there and grab that water, even though I know I'll get shot trying. But somehow, that doesn't seem to matter as much to my zombie brain as grabbing that water. It takes every ounce of self-control I have to stop myself and curtail my biological imperative. There's something wrong here, that voice in my head says. I look for something incongruous in the scene to confirm my analysis, and I find it. Because there's a purse on the ground. Items dumped. No sign of its owner. My neck hairs raise. This isn't just a bug out. It's a lair. and we have to stay far, far away. See, I've been to plenty of prepper conventions. There are basically two kinds of preppers. First are the ones like me and my family. We arm ourselves and stock up, but only to protect ourselves from the chaos. Then, there are the ones who bring the chaos. They wait for things to fall apart. They long for the lawlessness. Feed on it. Because there's nothing more exciting for them than the moment the world becomes their own personal video game. Those are the kind who play loud music in the woods that can be heard for miles, just to see who it attracts. They are the wolves waiting to see what kind of prey comes calling. But just like their open flame, they have failed to consider the consequences. Because if it's another predator who shows up instead of prey, these two can be picked off with a couple of well-placed shots. A twig snaps, and I spin to see Alyssa coming up behind me. "They have water," she whispers. She's seen it too. "Shh," I tell her, because the song is fading. We hold our silence, hold our breath until the next one starts. They didn't hear us. Dear God, I hope they didn't hear us. As the sounds of another Zep tune begin to blare, I move Alyssa farther away. "We don't want anything to do with that water," I tell her. "But..." I can't take the time to explain to her now. I grasp her shoulders. I look in her bloodshot eyes. "You have to trust me," I tell her. And she does. Reluctantly, but she does. And we return together to the truck. Jackie's kept the engine idling to keep the fan on, even though it's just blowing hot air. "We have to get out of here," I tell her as we climb in. "Don't gun the engine, just leave as quietly as you can." "Why?" "I'll tell you later," I say, "but we have to leave now." For a moment, I think Jackie might cave and accept my assessment of the situation, but Alyssa feels that she has to explain. That's not what we need in this moment. What we need is speed and stealth. "There are a couple of guys down there. Kelton thinks they might be dangerous." "Do they have water?" Jackie asks. Alyssa hesitates, and that tells the others all they need to know. Jackie opens the door and gets out of the car. While I can resist my zombie urge, Jackie's all about impulse, and I can see her turning. I get in front of her before she can make a mistake that will likely get her killed. "We're maybe an hour away from the reservoir," I remind her. "Then we'll have all the water we need." "Sounds like these guys are a bird in the hand," Jackie says. "So let's make them share." "Don't you get it?" I hiss. "They are not the sharing type. And they have guns that are bigger and badder than my Ruger." And suddenly a new voice enters the conversation, one that's been mostly quiet.
"Alyssa, I don't feel so good."
Garrett stands just beside the truck. He wavers for a moment like he's on the deck of a ship weathering a storm. Then, his eyes roll back, his knees give out, and he collapses. Alyssa hurries to him. I help her pick him up and put him back in the car. Henry gets out of the way so we can lie Garrett down on the back seat.
"I think it's okay," I tell Alyssa, who has forgotten anything else now but her brother.
"His blood pressure's probably low and he stood up too fast, that's all. He just has to lie down for a while." I hope I'm right. That's when I realize that something has changed. It takes a moment for me to realize what it is. The truck is no longer idling. The engine is off. Not only that, but the keys are gone. And so is Henry.
Henry.
There is no turning back, and no margin for error now. The opportunity presented itself, and I took it. Simple as that. Now I must follow through. Game theory suggests that success favors the decisive. Taking any action is always better than taking no action at all. So while the others argued and dealt with Garrett, I did what I had to do. Alyssa will not forgive me, I know, but I find that bothers me less than I thought it would. I follow the music, crest the ridge, and see the two men in their encampment. I hurl myself down toward them, falling to the ground and scraping my palms. I am on all fours and out of breath. They stand up and look at me, amused that I've tumbled into their presence. "Looks like we got ourselves a lunch guest," one of them says. But I'm not interested in their lunch, and they know it. because my eyes are fixed on the bottle of water that one of them holds in his big, hairy hand. When it comes to survival, there are harsh rules that go against the niceties of gracious living. Like in an airplane when the oxygen masks drop and everything goes haywire, they always tell you to put on your own mask first before helping others. But what if there's only one mask, and you're the one who gets it first? Well, I suppose you feel bad for the others, but whatever you do, you don't give that mask away. You breathe, and you breathe deep. "What can we do for you?" the one holding the water asks. "Today," I say, too winded to finish the thought, so I try again. "Today is your lucky day." Then I stand up, force fortitude to my legs, and begin negotiations.
44. Alyssa.
I stay with Garrett, not willing to leave him for a second. Kelton races off to track Henry, while Jackie desperately tries to hotwire the truck, but it's just not working. "Old cars are easy," she says, "but newer cars have a damn digital verification chip, and I don't think I can get around it." I know this is a terrible thing to say, even think, but right now, I wish Jackie had shot Henry when she had the chance. Why would he take the keys? What was he thinking? Then the two men from the rusty bug out come out of the woods in front of us, and I know where Henry went, and exactly what he was thinking when he went there.
"Hey there," the taller of the two says. "Having some car trouble?"
In spite of the friendly greeting, there's nothing else friendly about them. Up close, these men are intimidating, and intentionally so. They're muscular. They look like maybe they're 30, although they're weathered in a way that makes it hard to tell for sure. The shorter one has tattoo sleeves. Not artful ones, but ugly ones. Scrawled words and symbols, and all in the same bluish-black ink. The taller one has a shaved head and a scar that cuts diagonally across part of his scalp. We're always told not to judge a book by its cover, but there is nothing ambiguous about these two. Some people lack the imagination to do anything but embrace a stereotype and let it define them. These men lead violent lives, and they're happy to let the world know it. "Easy to get lost when you're off-roading," the one with the shaved head says. "Is that what you are? Lost?" I quickly look around. Kelton isn't back from his search for Henry. It's just me, Jackie, and Garrett, who's still unconscious in the back seat. "We don't want any trouble," I say, although out of the corner of my eye, I can see Jackie ready for all sorts of trouble.
That's good," says the inked one. "We don't want trouble either, but I'm afraid you're going to have to step away from our property."
"Excuse me," says Jackie. Then the inked one holds up my uncle's keychain.
"We just bought it," he says. "Your friend sold it to us for a nice guzzle of water."
The bald one laughs when he sees the look on Jackie's and my faces.
"Yeah, we poured it right into his hands, and he sucked it all down. Some of it spilled on his shoe, so he took his shoe off and licked the rubber dry. Damnedest thing. Then he took off down the mountain, one shoe on, one shoe off. Funny kid."
And I think how unfair it is that of the five of us, Henry's the only one who's had water. Probably enough for him to get out of this forest alive.
"I'll ask you one more time," says the inked one. "Step away from our property."
And he pulls out a no-nonsense handgun. He's not going to use it, I tell myself. It's to make a point. Like everything else about these two, it's meant to intimidate. But I will not give in to the intimidation. "We're going to the San Gabriel Reservoir," I tell him, not moving away from the door. "Let us get there, and then you can have the truck." The inked one shakes his head.
"Already a done deal. Nothing more to talk about."
"Now hold on," says the skinhead. "Let's not be hasty." And he drags his eyes across me, looking me up and down like I'm something up for auction. That's when Jackie makes her move. She launches herself at the Inked One, trying to grab his gun, but he's quick. He uses moves on her like the ones Kelton used on Henry. But this guy is stronger, faster. His moves are second nature. Jackie doesn't stand a chance. He uses her own momentum against her, twists her around like he's leading her in a swing dance, and forces her to the ground, pulling her arm at an unnatural angle, leaving her on her knees, grimacing and grunting in pain. "Play nice now," he says, and he doesn't release her arm, which keeps her incapacitated. Meanwhile, the skinhead hasn't taken his eyes off me. He moves closer. "Sucks for you that your boyfriend sold you out to save himself." "He's not my boyfriend," I say reflexively, but I wish I had said nothing. Because the skinhead says, "Even better," and he keeps moving closer. I try to knee him in the groin, and he reacts by lurching forward, pressing up against me, pushing me back against the side of the car, and leaving my knee no leverage. "We could share our water with you, if you'd act a little more civilized." But by the way he's pressing up against me, I know his idea of civil is not the same as mine. I can smell his breath now. Cigarettes and Doritos. I don't think I'll eat Doritos again for the rest of my life. I try to struggle, but I'm so weak from dehydration now, it's useless. I've never felt this helpless, and it's an awful, awful feeling. Because I realize he can do anything he wants to me now, and I'm not going to be able to stop him. "Don't you worry your pretty little head," he tells me quietly. "We'll go back to our camp, and it's all gonna be okay." Then suddenly Garrett's there, jumping out of the car and grabbing at him. "Get away from my sister!" He bites the arm that's holding me, and this burst of energy that Garrett has must give him superhuman strength, because it's like the bite of a shark, leaving a bloody, gaping wound. The skinhead screams in pain and pushes Garrett to the ground. I try to use the moment to break free, but he's got me wedged so tightly I still can't move. "You little shit! What did you do?" Then the Inked One looks at the blood pouring from his buddy's arm, and he turns, pointing his gun right at Garrett. "No!" I yell, and the world ends with a gunshot.
Jackie.
I see what's happening. I see all of it, and I can't stop it. I can't even get up because the goddamn tattooed bastard twists my arm whenever I try to move. All I can do is curse at him and threaten what I'll do to him when I'm free. I see the other one advance on Alyssa. I see her try to stop him. I don't hear what he whispers to her, but it can't be good. Then Garrett sits up in the car, finally conscious, with no idea what's going on. And seeing his sister cornered by the skinhead, he leaps right into the middle of a situation that's only going to get worse. The skinhead is screaming from one hell of a bite, and the Inked asshole, almost like it's a reflex, aims the gun at Garrett like he's about to shoot a rat that wandered into their camp. And in spite of the pain, I tug my body around, screaming, because if I can throw this guy off balance, his shot will go wild. A gunshot goes off, and suddenly his knees give out, and he goes down, and there's blood on his face, and there's blood on Garrett's face, too, but Garrett isn't dead. And I realize that the blood on Garrett's face, dripping from his mouth, is from the bite he gave the skinhead, but the Inked asshole's blood is his own. He's on the ground with a bullet hole in his forehead, just above his left eye. He shudders once, then goes limp. And Kelton stands 10 yards away, arm extended, his gun at the end of it. The other man freezes up, shocked. "Jesus H. Christ!" But he never completes the invocation of his Lord and Savior, because Kelton shifts his arm, fires again, and the bullet hits the skinhead in that space just beneath his nose. The exit wound splatters blood all over Alyssa's face. She's already screaming, so she just continues. I don't think she has any idea yet what's going on. All she probably sees in her mind is her brother dead on the ground, because that reality seemed so big a moment ago, it persists even after reality shifted elsewhere. If she lives through all of this, she's probably going to have nightmares about that moment that never happened for the rest of her life. The skinhead crumbles. I get to my feet, and Alyssa finally finds her way back to the real world. She steps over the dead skinhead and goes straight to Garrett. Are you okay? Are you okay? She wipes the blood from his mouth, reconfirming that it's not his. He nods, and she hugs him in a way that sisters never hug brothers, except when they're almost shot in the head. I go over to Kelton, who still holds the gun, eyes on the two men like they might still be alive, maybe because they kept their brains in their asses. Finally, he lowers the gun. I think he might start shaking or break down in some way, but he doesn't. Not at all. I hate the fact that he had to save us, but the situation could just as easily have been reversed, with me being the one to save the day. And as much as I hate to admit it, Kelton, who has actual training with weapons, is probably a much better shot than I am. Kelton takes a deep breath, and then another. Get the car keys and get their guns, he says calmly. Then we'll go to their camp and get their water. Good thinking, I say, noting how different this kid is now than the Kelton I met at the beach. I'm not sure which one I dislike less, the goofy loser who can't fire a weapon, or the kid who can kill two men in cold blood and not break a sweat. Well, none of us are sweating anymore, and we're not second-guessing each other either. We're finally in that single-minded place where we do what we have to do, whatever it is. Turns out only the Inked One was armed. Kelton takes the gun and looks it over. Desert Eagle with a muzzle brake, he says. Much better than mine. He claims it and offers me his gun. I hesitate because I don't want it anymore. I'll take it, says Alyssa. She still has blood splattered on her face. I decide not to mention it. You sure? Kelton asks. She nods. No one's ever going to put me in a position like that again. What about Henry? I ask. Kelton looks at his big, shiny new gun and shrugs. I'll save a bullet for him, he says. And for the life of me, I can't tell if he really means it.
46. Alyssa.
If I think too much right now, I'll lose my mind. There are two dead bodies in front of me. Can't think about it. My brother was almost murdered. Can't think about it. My parents might be floating face down in the Pacific Ocean. Can't think about it. What I can think about is the water that I know is just up the ridge and down by an old rusty camper. Alyssa, Garrett says, just as he said before he lost consciousness before. I don't feel so good. We're getting water, I tell him. It'll be okay. But I can't get up. I can't move. His voice is even weaker than before, and I think back to what Kelton said last night, how right before you die, your body will fight it. You'll have a burst of energy, the body's last attempt to save itself. And it dawns on me that Garrett just had that burst of energy, which means he could be only minutes away from closing his eyes forever. We have to hurry, I say to the others, not sparing another thought for the dead men. I pick up Garrett in my arms, and although I barely have the strength to hold up my own weight, I bear his as well, as we make our way toward the campsite.
47. Kelton.
It was different than I thought it would be. I expected it to feel monumental, like ripping a hole in the universe. But it wasn't. Pop, pop. Simple as that. Now two men are dead, and we're alive. I wasn't angry, like I was back in our house when I almost turned a shotgun on our marauding neighbors. I wasn't scared, like I was when the water zombie kid on the beach was trying to suck the water right out of Alyssa's mouth. Pop. Pop. Done. Move on. Like I said, these guys were feeding on the chaos, living by video game rules. And in a game, when you defeat an enemy, what do? You take their weapons. Which is exactly what I did. Is that why I don't feel anything? Because I'm living by those rules now too? We reach the top of the ridge and look down on the campsite to see that the campfire, without anyone to watch it, has gotten out of control. The brush is burning. The two lawn chairs are burning. And the fire has reached the cooler beside them. It's burning, giving off a rancid chemical smell. The lid is open, and I can see splashes as the water bottles inside begin to burst.
Oh no!
Alyssa puts Garrett down. Don't move! I'll be right back! Alyssa, Jackie, and I race down trying to get to the water, but the fire is too hot.
God damn it!
Jackie tries to reach through the flames, but screams, curling her hands. She's burned herself. Still, she reaches in again. The second time must be so painful that she backs away, wailing in pain.
No! She screams. It's not fair! It's not fair!
Look for something we can use to pull the cooler out of the flames, I say. But Alyssa's looking toward the camper.
This might not be all the water they have, she says. I'll check inside.
She runs around the growing fire to the camper. The wind is blowing in that direction. It's only a matter of time until that's on fire, too.
Okay, but hurry,
I yell after her, and I begin searching for a branch large enough to reach into the flames and pull out the burning cooler.
48. Alyssa.
I throw open the door of the camper. It doesn't smell good in here. I didn't expect it to. It doesn't look all that different from Kelton's bug out on the inside. Food containers and dirty clothes. And something I wasn't expecting at all.
Benji? Is that you?
I follow the voice to the trailer's bedroom. There's a woman in there. Old, sick. A floral print house dress. Fuzzy pink slippers. She regards me with suspicion, pulling the covers over her.
Who are you? Where's Benji? Where's Kyle?
They sent me in, I tell her. They sent me in for the water. Her suspicion grows.
They got all the water already in the cooler. Who are you?
She asks again. I look around the room, refusing to believe there's no water left in here. She sees what I'm doing, and she realizes that her suspicions are justified. She begins to look a little bit scared.
They didn't send you. Get out of here. You're trespassing. Get out of here now.
I know she doesn't have a weapon of her own, because if she did, she'd have already reached for it. I have one, though. But I won't threaten an old woman with a gun. That's not who I am. My eyes scan everywhere, and I see things I don't want to see. Because on a counter by the bed, she has set up a miniature version of what must sit on her mantle at home, wherever that is. There are pictures there. Two boys, different ages. One grabs my attention. A faded picture of the same two boys in Mickey Mouse hats, making faces at the camera. And I realize, Benji and Kyle, they were brothers. I don't want to know this. I don't want to know that they ever wore Mickey Mouse hats. I don't want to know that someone has pictures of them on her bedside table. One of those little boys was going to shoot Garrett. The other one was going to rape me. Wasn't he? Wasn't he? Is that smoke? The old woman says. What's going on out there? You can't stay here, I say. You can come with us. And the second I say it, I realize that if she does, she's going to see her two dead sons lying in front of the truck. I'm not going anywhere, she says, not grasping the bigger picture. Do I look like I'm up for a hike? She purses her lips and shakes her head. You better get out of here before they come back. Nothing they hate more than trespassers. And then I see it. A plastic cup of water on a window ledge, just out of the woman's reach. She sees that I see it. She gauges me. It's a standoff. And she lunges for it. I lunge too, but she gets it first. She clutches it to her chest, and I grab for it. "It's mine," she says. "This is my water, not yours." The water sloshes in the cup as I try to grab it from her, spilling over the edge. I can't grapple for it, because if I do, it will all spill out. "Benji! Kyle! Help!" I grab her hand, trying to stop the water from splashing. She takes her other hand and tries to push me away. Then she moves the cup toward her lips. I know this is all the water she has, all the water that's left. If I take it, this woman will die. If I don't take it, my brother will die. So I do something terrible. I slap her. I slap her hard. It makes her lose her focus, and I'm able to slip the cup from her hand. More water spills over the side. There's not much left now. An ounce, maybe two. Not enough to quench anyone's thirst, but maybe enough to keep my brother alive. I back away from her. "The fire's almost at the door," I tell her. "You need to get out of here." But even if she does, what good will it do? She's out in the middle of nowhere, alone. If the fire doesn't get her, she'll die of thirst out here. But still, I turn my back on her and leave, because I have made my choice. If she has to die for my brother to live, then I will take her water and leave her to die. Henry was right. Sometimes it's the monsters who survive. And now I am the monster.
49. Jackie.
My hands, how stupid could I be, my hands? And still I want to push my arms through the flames to that cooler that burns there in the middle of hell. My fingers and palms are already swelling with blisters, the pain resolving into a dull throbbing. Kelton returns with a branch and pokes it toward the cooler. He hooks the end around the lip. Oh, my hands. He pulls on the stick and the cooler moves half an inch. He pulls again. It slips another half inch closer. He tugs harder. And the whole side, half molten, rips open, spilling water into the fire. No! The water steams, and as the steam clears, I can see the few remaining water bottles at the bottom of the ruptured cooler melt, spilling the contents out pointlessly, uselessly. It does nothing to quell the fire because the flames just close in and the remaining sides of the cooler collapse. It's gone, all gone. And when I look up, I can see how far the fire has spread. The winds are fanning it. One more fire to add to the ones that are already blazing in the mountains around us. Alyssa bursts out of the trailer, leaping over the flames that are about to engulf it. She's holding something. What is that? Is that a cup? She holds it like it's something precious. And it is. I could take it from her. I could catch up with her and take it and drink it, quench this thirst that burns even more than my hands. But I won't, because I know that water's not for her. I won't take it, because even though I've seen everyone around me lose their humanity today, I realize that in this moment I have finally found mine.
50. Alyssa.
Garrett is exactly where I left him, on the ridge above the burning campsite, leaning against a tree. His head is lolling to one side. His eyes are slits. He might already be dead. I can't see him breathing. He might already be dead. Garrett! Garrett, I'm here! I kneel beside him. I lift the cup to his lips. I pour a little in. What if he doesn't swallow? What if he can't swallow? Because he's already dead. Water dribbles out of the side of his mouth. I was too slow. I should have pulled out the gun and shot that woman the second I saw the cup of water. That's what I should have done. It would have saved me 10 seconds. 10 seconds that would have saved my brother's life. Swallow, Garrett. Damn it, swallow. Then he coughs. He coughs. His eyes open the tiniest bit wider. It's water, Garrett, I tell him. Swallow it. I'm trying, he rasps. It's hard. He closes his eyes. He forces a swallow. I pour a little more in his mouth. He swallows again. I pour all the rest in. It's easier for him to swallow the third time. He doesn't look any better. He's not any stronger. But I know that water is in there. Water absorbs into the body faster than anything. It will be gone from his stomach in minutes. Even faster when he's this dehydrated. His body will suck it in like a sponge. Is that all you've got? He asks, and I actually laugh. There will be more, I tell him. Only now do I look back down to the campsite. Jackie and Kelton are climbing away from it toward me. The fire has already spread to the trees at an alarming rate. Did the old woman get out of the camper? I ask them, now that my tight sphere of concern can extend beyond my brother. Kelton looks at Jackie, then back at me. There was an old woman in the camper? I look down to the campsite again. The trailer and the brush all around it are fully engulfed in flames. The door is still open, the way I left it. I hear no screams. But what could I do about them even if I did? The path to the camper is completely blocked by the fire. We've got to move, Kelton says. So I bend down, pick up Garrett, and go back to the truck, trying to forget I ever